some basics of prophecy. We are going to, and I am going to be talking more and more about prophecy as time goes on. Prophecy has not been my strong suit, but with the church's help and with the things that are available to us from the United Church of God, I am going to be able to give you some things that we understand from church prophecy. Again, not every week by any means, but perhaps once every other month or once every 6 weeks, I will try to have a sermon dealing with prophecy so that we're keeping up with things and that we are making sure that we are not leaving a very important part of the Bible undone or not talked about. But before we do that, and before we get into that, there are some things that we have to understand and realize about prophecy that we either have perhaps have forgotten or that perhaps we need to understand for the first time. And let's go to Matthew 24, where Jesus Christ talks about something that was going to happen. One of the things that we have talked about for many, many years, Mr. Armstrong, was given that understanding, and certainly it is proven to be true. For example, when Mr. Armstrong started talking about prophecy and prophecy being dual, we didn't have the information that was available to us that we have here. In Matthew 24, starting out in verse 1, Matthew 24, starting out in verse 1, and Jesus went out and departed from the temple, which had just recently been finished, been 40 years in the, at least in the making, and probably in the planning even longer than that. And his disciples came up to show him the buildings in, of the temple, and it was magnificent. It was one of the certainly finest examples of structures at that time in the world, and certainly in the Middle East, there in the area of Jerusalem and Judea and so forth. And they were very proud of it. And Jesus said to them, "Do you not see all of these things? You know, look at these things." And he said, "Verily or assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down." And as I said, when Mr. Armstrong was first talking about this, Jerusalem was under the control of the Arabs, and the Temple Mount was, was just a mound with the Islamic temple, not temple, I shouldn't put that, but building on it. And it wasn't until the Israelis took over that portion of the city in 1967 and started archaeologically excavating the Temple Mount area that they found what the Jews call the Wailing Wall, and it was intact. Now you had to go down to it because it was no longer above ground level. You had to dig down, but that they did, and to this day it is a very sacred area for Jews around the world, and certainly for the nation of Israel. But as they excavated it, we found out something very interesting, that the temple and the temple walls were not totally razed at the time of the Romans. There were certain walls left completely intact. In fact, certainly the Wailing Wall being a very good example of this, blocks were still on top of blocks just as they had been when they were laid there or put there at the time of Herod. And so what we realize from that is that the prophecy about what Jesus Christ was talking about could not have been totally fulfilled at that time when Jerusalem was destroyed in or around 69 AD, because he says, "Not one stone shall be left here upon another." And yet, to this day, they are. To this day, there are stones of that original temple that are left on top of one another. And Christ said there's going to come a time when they're all going to be thrown down. So we understand from that there is yet a future and more complete fulfillment of what is going to take, what did take place and what will take place in the future. This is just one example of many, many examples. In fact, I don't know, half or more of the prophecies given in the Bible are dual, that there is a basic fulfillment or a preliminary fulfillment, but the ultimate fulfillment comes at the end, you know, just before the return of Christ. But what I really would like us to zero in before we really get involved in some things is found starting in Matthew 24 and verse 42. Matthew 24 and verse 42. Jesus Christ says, "Watch therefore, for you do not know the hour your Lord is coming." Now, we know that a day is as a year in fulfillment of prophecy, and this term here, hour, does not mean 60 minutes. It means, obviously, a more precise time, a much more precise time than a day. But what Jesus Christ is getting at is that even though we can have some very, you know, we might be able to narrow down his coming, quite a bit, that the actual return, his actual return, we will not know. Now, doesn't that fly in the face of what we think prophecy is all about? Don't we think prophecy is to foretell us exactly what's going to happen? And yet Jesus Christ here himself says that is not the case. That is not really the overall purpose for prophecy, as we will find out as we will go on. And these are some things that we need to understand and realize before we get into prophecy, that when we start talking about prophecy and when we start talking about some specific things, that we always have to remember this point here. Number one is that we cannot fix the exact time. And anyone who says they can is not understanding prophecy the way they should. Okay, because this, you know, I didn't put this, you know, I didn't say this. This is, hopefully you're all reading this out of your own Bible. You will not know the exact or precise time, or even, again, keeping in mind that hour does not mean 60 minutes here, the, you know, getting it down to a date on the calendar specifically. He said, "But know this, if the master of the house had known the hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into." I mean, if you knew, for example, that your house was going to be burglarized on Halloween night, sometime between, you know, midnight and 5 o'clock, well, wouldn't you call the police and tell them? You know, hopefully we wouldn't sit up with a shotgun and then so forth, as one man did that my father talks about. You have to understand, when my parents were growing up and keeping Halloween, or, you know, following Halloween, that things were different. They had outhouses back then. You know, they had these little buildings that you went to. And this one farmer was so sick and tired of having his outhouse upset every Halloween that he was going to fix them, and he was going to wait inside, and when he heard them coming, he was going to come out with his shotgun and, you know, shoot it in the air and scare them off. Well, the problem was he fell asleep. And they pushed the outhouse over with him sitting inside. And he got so scared he shot through the roof. Fortunately, no one was injured, but now he not only had an upset outhouse, but he had the tin roof with his great fake holes in it. I'm sorry, I digress here. But as he said, if we would have known that our house was going to be burglarized, not that it has to get down to the last moment or within the hour, but I mean, if we knew it was going to be sometime like tonight, I mean, we'd take all the precautions that would be necessary. You know, we'd set up our own maybe, videotape recorder or something. We'd make sure that we'd catch these people in the act or keep them from doing it, one or the other. In verse 44, he says, "Therefore you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour that you do not expect." Okay, so any time you expect him to return, forget it, because it's not going to happen. And I believe this firmly. I believe Jesus Christ knows what he's talking about here. You know, we used to be so specific, and we used to know, you know, that it was going to take, something was going to take place in February, and then 1150 days later, this was going to happen, and then we were going to flee. And, you know, we had this all figured out before 1972, and it didn't happen, because we read these scriptures, yeah, that's right, but, you know, this just fits so well. This just really fits into, you know, our understanding. And it, as we know, it didn't happen. Could it have happened? Sure, it could have happened, but it didn't. And it still hasn't happened to this day. But as Mr. Armstrong, you know, had a habit of saying, is that, you know, after that period of time, his return is much closer than it was in 1972 or 1975 or 1980 or 85 or any prior date. We are much closer to the return of Jesus Christ than we were ever 25 years ago. And that's the thing that we need to remember, that his coming is still going to happen, and we are to watch, and we are to be ready, as it says here in verse 44. And that's an interesting concept. What do you mean, be ready? How are we to be ready? What is it that we are to be ready, or how is it that we are supposed to be prepared? He answers that question starting in verse 45. Who then is that faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give him food in due season? Verse 46, blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, on his timeline, on his date, not ours, will find him so doing. Doing what? You know, waiting up with a shotgun for the thief? No. We are to be doing our Christian work, you know, growing, overcoming, setting an example. Yes, getting the gospel out. All of these things are part of that. Not going to the rooftop in our white robes made out of our bed sheets and, you know, holding up our hands and waiting for the Lord to return. That isn't our job. Our job is to grow, to overcome, live by every word of God, seek the kingdom of God and his righteousness first, and then we will be doing exactly what the master of the house, meaning God himself, wants us to do. He goes on in verse 47, or let's start in verse 48 for sake of time. If that evil servant says in his heart, my master delays his coming, he should have come, but he didn't, so therefore, all bets are off. Everything is now, it's really not going to happen after all. And he starts becoming evil. Maybe he was able to keep himself in line with the idea, look, anybody can be good for, you know, a certain period of time. You know, I can stay married. You know, I can be good. I can do all things if I know that it's going to end in 3 years or 2 years or something like that. I can be good for that length of time. You know, I can you know, just bite my tongue and not answer back, and I can do all of these things. But you take that pressure off, and you have to live with indefiniteness, living with the fact that we don't know, not if, but when Christ will come. The evil servant might say, I'm not even sure if he's going to come. And he starts doing things wrong. The analogy here is that this servant starts beating his fellow servants in verse 49 to eat and drink with the drunkards. In verse 50, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him, and at an hour he is not aware of, and cut him in two, and appoint his portion with the hypocrites, and there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So, you know, our job is not to anticipate to the hour or even the day Christ's return, but it is to anticipate, yes, Jesus Christ's return is not that far off, and therefore we need to use that as incentive and say, how am I doing? Am I growing? Am I overcoming? Am I using his spirit that he has given me? Or am I becoming like this evil servant and just saying, forget it? because, as I said, prophecy is not meant to tell us exact times or the timing per se. And therefore, you might say the moral about prophecy is, if you wish to have a story with a moral, is that you have to be careful with prophecy. You have to be very careful that you do not lock in dates. You do not lock in, some very specific things. It's okay to, speculate as long as you're willing to acknowledge that it is speculation, that it doesn't become your baby in the sense that it becomes so important to you, this particular tidbit of prophecy that you or I think we understand, and it becomes so important that we throw out goodness and mercy and love and overcoming and things like that. And some have. Some have. I had a friend in college who has become like this, and somehow or another he got my email address, and he is sending me some very, unfortunately, what I consider to be weird and way out the things. I want to put it, on me, about, even such things about a new Hitler and about Hitler maybe being alive yet and all sorts of things. Because, as I said, we have to be very careful with prophecy because that's not its purpose. That's not the idea behind it. Okay, let's, in examining prophecy, there's one major, major thing we must understand about prophecy, and that is this. Real prophecy, for it to be true, and for it to be something that we should be interested in, must fit into God's time frame and his overall frame that he himself set up. Because right now, as I'm just using my friend as an example, there are many people who are coming up with ideas about what Revelation say, Matthew and Daniel and Ezekiel and Jeremiah and so forth, and many different ideas involving many different countries, many different scenarios and so forth. And all of this is because they have forgotten God's time frame, and not only his time frame, but his prophetical frame that he gave us in the book of Daniel in chapter 2. And everything about prophecy in some way must fit into this framework or it isn't true, period. And again, this is not me saying this. This is what we find in the Word of God, and specifically now in Daniel, for us to study and to understand. And therefore, everything about prophecy and about future events has to fit into this overall framework, this skeletal framework that we have here. And in chapter 2, and I'm sure we all know this particular story, the king, Nebuchadnezzar, had a dream, or actually, it says he had dreams, probably the same one, that occurred either in one night or over a succession of nights, and was so bad that his sleep left him. And if this was over a succession of nights, you can imagine poor Nebuchadnezzar was losing out on sleep, and this was really bothering him. So he called his soothsayers, his Chaldeans, his astrologers to him, and they came before him, and he says, I need to know what this dream means. I've had this dream, and I need to know what it means. And the soothsayer says, we'll tell you, we'll be happy to tell you, we'll give you the answer. Just tell us what it was. And Nebuchadnezzar was too wise for them. He says, I don't exactly remember the dream, but I know it troubled me. So I want you to tell me the dream, and then what it means. And they came back to him and says, well, nobody can do that. He said, what do you mean? Aren't you supposed to be soothsayers and astrologers and be able to know all things? Yeah, but nobody can know, what your dream was. You've got to tell us the dream, and then we'll tell you what it means. Yeah, right. Well, anyway, it goes down to Verse 9, he says, if you do not make the dream to me, Nebuchadnezzar said, there is only one decree for you, that you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time has changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation. And the Chaldeans, who seem to be the kind of the head guys of these soothsayers and the dream interpreters, answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, ruler has ever asked such thing of any magician, astrologer, or even of a Chaldean. And it's an impossible, not a difficult thing that the Lord requests. It's an impossible thing. And there is no other who can tell the king except the gods, who dwelling is not with the flesh. And so the king got so mad, he said, I'm going to kill all you guys off. You know, all of you who call yourself wise men and soothsayers and so forth. Unfortunately, when he said wise men, he included a group of people therein that perhaps he didn't mean to. And that was Daniel and his three companions. And so the captain of the guard came to Daniel's house to kill him. And of course, you know, if I were Daniel, I'd do the same thing. Why? You know, why do you want to kill me? What have I done? Well, king says we got to get rid of all you guys. Who guys? What guys? Well, all you soothsayers. We're not soothsayers. All you wise men. Okay. We have been called that. He says, why is it in verse 15 so urgent? And the captain of the guard, Arioch, made the whole thing known to Daniel. So Daniel went in, it says in verse 16, and asked the king to give him some time that he would tell the king the interpretation. And this goes back to Nebuchadnezzar now. He was able to approach Nebuchadnezzar directly. Even though his life was on the line and he was set up for execution, he was able to go and get this extension, if you will, from the king. And so Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, all sought the mercies in verse 18 of the God of heaven concerning this secret. And it says in verse 19, the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Now, the interesting thing is about this is that God gave a dream not to Daniel, the prophet, but he gave it to the greatest, or the greatest civil leader, world leader that this world has ever seen, just as far as richness and overall wealth and influence that Nebuchadnezzar reigned over in his lifetime. This dream was actually given to him. Now, granted, Daniel, with God's inspiration, had to interpret it, but it wasn't given to Daniel. It's the interesting thing. And there's a reason for it, as we will go on to see. And so he is given both the dream and the interpretation. And so in verse 25, Arioch quickly brings Daniel before the king, and he says, I have found among the Jewish captives one who says he can explain what the dream is all about. And in verse 27, the king in verse 26 says to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? And notice what Daniel says in verse 27. The secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. Verse 28, but there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Very important that he showed a world-ruling leader what was going to happen in the latter days. And this is the framework, then, that we have to base all of our understanding of prophecy on. Your dream, the visions on your head, upon your bed, were these. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed, this is verse 29 now, about what would come to pass after this. So from that time forward, and he who reveals secrets has made known to you what shall be. And starting in verse 1, he reveals first of all the dream about this great image. The image's head, verse 32, was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze. Verse 33, its legs of iron, feet partly of clay and of iron and partly of clay. And you watched while stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. In verse 35, then the iron, the clay, and the bronze, and the silver, and the gold were all crushed together, came kind of crashing down, much like how they take down buildings nowadays. Have you ever noticed that if they want to, you know, get rid of a building, how they dynamite it? They dynamite it in such a way that it doesn't fall over. It just kind of comes down on itself with this great big cloud of dust and so forth. And they do it in such a careful and orchestrated way. It's really interesting to how they do that. And this, it seems, is like what happened there. This stone, which became large, struck it at its feet, and it just sort of came down and came down in fine, minute pieces. It broke up, and this is what he is getting across to Nebuchadnezzar. And he said, they were all crushed together. Now, middle of verse 35. And became like chaff from the summer threshing floor. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. And he says in verse 36, that's the dream. Now we will tell you the interpretation of it before the king. And he says in verse 37, you, O king, are the king of kings. For the God of heaven has given you kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or beasts of the field, and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand, and has made you ruler over them all. You are the head of gold. He says in verse 39, after you shall arise a kingdom inferior to yours. But interestingly enough, the metal that is used is actually a little more, or let's put it this way, a little less malleable than gold. Gold, you hit with a hammer, and you can change. You will dent it. Even a bar of gold, you will dent it. Bronze is a little harder. I'm sorry, silver is a little harder metal. And then you come down to bronze, which is even harder yet. And by the time you come down to the iron, you hit that with an iron hammer, and your hand's vibrating because iron hitting iron isn't going to necessarily damage it. And then you in verse 40. The fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break into pieces and crush all others. Verse 41, whereas you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. So what do we have here? We have, and we know this from what Daniel himself says, Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold. The next one that followed him was the Persian Empire, which was also very great, but it was, again, it didn't have the influence or the wealth or the resources of the Nebuchadnezzar's great empire. But it was still a very powerful, powerful empire. And then after that, am I getting ahead of myself here? Then comes the bronze. And I thought, what am I missing? Which one was the one of bronze? Forgetting now. That would be a little bit later, because then comes the Greco-Macedonian Empire. Persians were next, and then the Greco-Macedonian Empire was the bronze. I thought I was getting ahead of myself here. The interesting thing after that, we have then the two legs of iron, and we see that the Roman Empire basically went down into two different areas that it was controlled eventually, and then we get down into the lower legs of and the ankles and the feet itself, where you have the clay and the iron mixed, which is the the you know the Roman Empire, which was very powerful, but it yet it also had some problems. Now the thing that's really interesting is if you think of iron and clay, and you look at that and you think how can you have this together? It would look so mottled and it would just look very, you know, terrible. But what it says up here in verse 41, it says, it is iron mixed with ceramic clay. Now you begin to understand what you're seeing here. Ceramic clay glazed looks very stable. And it you can glaze that, and I think the glaze is actually heated to such a point where the silicon becomes the glaze, and it's like glass, and it looks, you know, not only beautiful, but it looks strong. And you put shiny iron or steel, you know, next to it, and you can't really, you know, depending upon the color of the ceramic clay, you really can't tell the difference. You almost need a magnifying glass to see, you know, any type of dividing lines. But when it comes to actually having the strength, the overall strength of iron or steel, it doesn't. It, when put to the test, it will not hold up. It will fracture. It will break, under any type of stress whatsoever. And so that is where this rock or this stone that is cut without hand hits the image at its feet, and it broke into pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. And the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. He says it again. This is the dream. Notice this. The dream is certain, and the interpretation is sure. So that's the framework that all prophecy from that time forward has to fit into. And so if it doesn't fit into and help define these world-ruling empires, and if we try to say that these world-ruling empires ending up with the Roman Empire with its 10 resurrections, if you will, if we try to say, well, Pakistan's involved here, and Pakistan is one of the toes, or which is what somebody once said, or you know something else, it's not part of the framework. This is not part of the framework. This is not what God tells us will come to pass after this. And so, as I said, we have to make sure that prophecy and that our understanding of prophecy fits within this framework. Okay. Now that we have discussed that a little bit, let's go back to Matthew 24, where Christ gives us a kind of an overview of what is going to happen. And let's look at what he actually says so that we don't become deceived, which is one of the things that he makes very, very clear can happen. So we already talked about how one stone would not be left upon another in verse 2 of Matthew 24. Now, starting in verse 3, when Christ sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when shall these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" Now, I don't know if they understood what they were saying here. In fact, I'm pretty sure they didn't. But you can divide that up into three things. When will these things be? That's one. What will be the sign of your coming? That's two. And the end of the age? Three. They probably thought all of these things were concurrent. All of these things would be at the same time. But as we will see, and as I think we already know, that is not necessarily so. That is not necessarily the case. The first thing that Jesus said to him in verse 4, take heed that no one deceives you. Because it is so easy to deceive with prophecy. It is so easy to say, look, if you understand this, everything will be fine. You'll be spared. You won't have to worry about any of this. Just believe my view of prophecy. And Jesus said, "Take heed that no one will deceive you, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many." In verse 6, "You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled," because that's been going on since time immemorial, ever since Satan was in charge of the world. "For these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." Verse 7, "For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places." And he said, "All of these are the beginning of sorrows." Then, verse 9, "They will deliver you up to the tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated of all nations for my name's sake." Now, there's a duality in there, because that happened, after Christ died. I mean, from that time forward, they were persecuted, and they suffered tribulation, and they were driven off, and they were hated, and they were hunted and killed in all nations for his name's sake. In verse 10, it says, "Many will be offended and betray one another and hate one another," and this also has occurred. "Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will wax or grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved." Now verse 14, it says, "This gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all nations, and then the end will come." And of course, being part of the body of Christ, we want to be a part of that. We want to help out with that. That is our avowed desire and purpose, and we are striving to prepare ourselves to make sure that God will allow us to carry this out. But we also know that before the end comes, before Jesus Christ comes, there are going to be two witnesses, and they're going to be seen by the entire world. And we don't know who those two witnesses are, but that's part of what he is talking about. It isn't just what we do. It isn't just what we have done in the past. It is also what is going to be happening, especially right before Jesus Christ returns. He says, "And then shall the end come." Now in verse 15 he says, "And when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place," and he said, "Whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are," notice, "in Judea flee to the mountaintops. And let him who is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes." Verse 19, "But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days." And he says in verse 20, "And pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath." Interesting. Many years after the death of Christ, when this prophecy was going to take place, I'm talking about the first time, you know, when Rome surrounded Jerusalem and then backed off for a little bit and then giving the inhabitants a short period of time to get out of there. Long after the church had been established, long after any Jewish concept should have been out of the church, Christ says, "Pray that your flight not be on the Sabbath," that the Sabbath would still be important way, way after his death, way after the establishment of the Christian church, and way after whatever had been done away with was done away, as far as they look at it. Verse 21, "For then there will be a great tribulation, such as not has been seen since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be." I don't want to gloss over that verse. That is awesome in its portent. Because this world has seen an awful lot of misery and has seen an awful lot of tragedy, and people have died in horrible, grotesque, and horrendous ways. And yet it talks about there's coming a time that we can't even imagine how bad it's going to be. It is going to be far beyond what we even consider or contemplate. We are going to be not only shocked, but I think we will be numb by what this world will be going through in the years ahead. He says in verse 22, "And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened." And then once again he says, "And if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is Christ,' do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. In verse 25, see, I have told you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, look, he is in the desert, don't go out. Look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. Verse 27, for as lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. Now, there's a little problem with that. The term lightning there does mean lightning, as we think of it, you know, either the stab or the fork lightning, or sometimes if you see it in clouds, it lights up the whole cloud and so forth. The term can also mean light. The thing that we have to consider about this is, what light goes from the east to the west? Sun. And it seems as though what this is talking about, just like the sun gets up in the east because of the rotation of the earth and sets in the west, and we know when the sun is up, don't we? There is no question in our minds, and no matter how foggy or how cloudy the day is, we know the difference between daylight and nighttime. And so will the coming of the Son of Man be. It won't be like a flash of lightning. It won't be like, lighting up the clouds. This is something that is going to take place over a period of time. And when Christ returns, we're going to have at least one complete cycle of day before he actually comes to this earth, before he actually touches down on this earth. That's what it seems to say. Now, as I said, I cannot prove that except from the wording itself, because the term lightning here can mean lightning or it can mean light. But the only light that goes regularly from east to west is the sun. Lightning doesn't necessarily go east to west, does it? It goes up and down. It can go west to east. It can go different ways. There's only one light that goes east to west with any regularity. So, and again, in Revelation, when it talks about the whole world seeing Christ, how can the whole world see Christ unless the world is rotating, and he takes at least a 24-hour period to return? Okay, verse 28, and wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together, is a kind of a grotesque way of saying wherever the body is, the vultures are going to find it. Meaning that wherever he is, the angels are going to gather up all of the people that are his and are going to bring them to him. And including with the sound of that seventh trumpet, even those who are dead, they will rise to meet him in the air along with those who are alive. Now in verse 29, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven and with power and great glory. Verse 31, and he will send his angels out with the sound of a great trumpet, probably the seventh, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. The heaven meaning under the canopy that we call the atmosphere. And some people have died in the atmosphere. And there may be some astronauts floating around at that time, or people who are just orbiting this earth. There are others who have been disintegrated by atomic and bomb blasts and so forth, who have become part of the atmosphere. They may have settled back down again, pieces of ash. But they're going to make sure that everyone who has died, everyone, no matter where they are going to be gathered together. In verse 32, and learn the parable from the fig tree. When the branches already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you will know that summer is near. So also, when you see all of these things, know that it is near at the doors. Assuredly, verse 34, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all of these things take place. Okay, which generation is he talking about? Which generation is he talking about? Is he talking about the generation that he was talking to? Obviously not. So which generation that he is speaking about in the future was still going to be there when he would return till these things will have taken place? Well, let's look at what it says. Verse 7 talks about nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, famines, pestilences, earthquakes in various places. You know, a lot of people have thought at various times in history that when certain things occurred, like the, was it the bubonic plague of Europe or the pneumonic plague of Europe, that that was the end of the world. And for some, it really was. What was it that Europe lost? 22 million during the Dark Ages due to these diseases? Unbelievable. And you have to remember population of Europe wasn't that great. And 22 million means at least half, if not more than half of the people died off due to this plague. You can imagine they thought that this was the end of the world. Or when some of these horrendous earthquakes took place, or World War I, many people thought that this was the end of the world, that this was going to usher in the end of the world. Mr. Armstrong even thought at the beginning of World War II that possibly this could be it, until he saw that the Allies were going to be given by God's grace, the upper hand, and to be able to conquer. Even it says in just the beginning of sorrows, and even the delivering up to tribulation and killing you, being hated of all nations for my name's sake, is something that the true church has had to experience from that time up until now. The offenses that would take place, and false prophets, and the lawlessness will cause people to lose their love and grow cold. And then it talks about in verse 13, enduring to the end, and how this gospel of the kingdom will be preached to the world as a witness to all nations to that end, to that time. So something from this verse 14 on should indicate what when this generation starts, or when it, again, not that we're trying to put an exact date on it, but to give us an idea of which generation he is talking about. In verse 21, about this great tribulation. He says in verse 22, unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days would be shortened. When was it possible to annihilate all human life off the face of the earth? That was the beginning, but they only had three bombs. But you're on the right track. Actually, yes. Many people think it was earlier than that, and it really wasn't. We had the hydrogen bomb. We exploded the first test hydrogen bomb in 1954. But there was only one. And they made a couple of more hydrogen bombs, but these were boxcar-sized devices. They couldn't even be carried by planes of that date, of that time. And they had to be brought in place and built for these tests. So you go to 54, 55, and into 1960, and by then, by the time of 1960, both the United States and Russia were building up their nuclear stockpiles. By the time of 1961, with the Cuban crisis, they really first talked about the real possibility of annihilating all life. Because now they had both missiles and planes that could deliver, you know, room-sized bombs, or these bombs were now small enough that they could actually deliver them, and it would have been possible for life to be annihilated. You have to take into consideration, of course, fallout along with this. And that due to not just explosions, not just to due to the number of explosions, but due to the fallout, the radioactive fallout, there was then raised the heinous head of the fact that that human life could actually disappear from this earth. And so, you know, for the sake of making things a little easier, let's use 1960 as a time. Okay, 1960 is, wow, that's 39 years ago. That's more than a generation, right? And nothing has happened. So what are we talking about? Well, it doesn't exactly say that, does it? It says in verse 34, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away until all of these things take place. You know, somebody who's born in 1960 or thereabouts is only 39. You know, if he lives as long as Mr. Armstrong, he's got a ways to go yet. In other words, there will be some who were born during this time who will still be alive before, or still alive when everything occurs. Now, that's as close as I can come to it. You know, I'm not, you know, does that mean we have 25 more years or 50 more years? I don't know. That's the only indication I can get out of this, that I can actually nail something down and say, when did we really become possible for us to kill all life, human life off the earth? Around that time, you know, people live a long time, as you know, if we use Mr. Armstrong as an example. So sometime between 1960 and, if you wish to push it out, 90 years, sometime between now and 90 years from 1960, you know, the possibility of Christ returning, as far as I'm concerned, is rather high. And when you look at what's happening around the world and what's happening and how it really seems, that there's a scripture, and I was trying to think about it before I came here, but God talks about that the wickedness of his people, of Israel, was going to become so great that he would take his hedge away from them. You know, that he would take this kind of a protection that he has placed upon his people, you know, the people of Abraham. And, you know, I really wonder if we haven't come into that place where that is just beginning, where things are happening, and God says, I'm just going to let it happen. If there's going to be a hurricane, I'm just going to let it take its course. I'm not going to push it off the coast. I'm not going to deviate it from it. Whatever it's going to do, it's going to do from now on. Because my people have no love for me. My people have no care for the, you know, true Christian values anymore whatsoever. I really wonder if we are not, you know, beginning to see that hedge that God has placed around his physical people taken away. Any comments? Anything that perhaps in your studies of prophecy that you would like to bring out, or that you would perhaps have a question about some of these basics? Yes, Mrs. Johnson. No, it only says that the whole world will see him. And in that sense, whether you look at it from the position of someone on the earth, you know, it looks like the sun is moving, doesn't it? And in that sense, he would circle the earth. But it'd only be from, you know, from our position on earth. Because just as the sun goes from east to west, you know, Jesus Christ, as he returns, is going to look like he's going from east to west. Thank you for that question, by the way. Any other questions or comments? Mr. Bilichek.
Is Oscar going forth to all nations? Now, there are those that say you are preaching the gospel. You are going all over the world. You got stations in Africa, India, Russia. So, that either that, if they still live in the gospel, then they're a deceiving of the world.
But see, there's one thing that we have to be careful about, and that is, everything I read in the Bible, when it talks about the gospel being preached to the whole world, that it's going to have some sort of an effect, that it, even a negative effect, that we're going to, that people are going to be persecuted because of it, that it's going to be something that they don't want to hear. And they say, you know, get rid of this radio broadcast, you know, get rid of these things. I mean, when I was back in England going to college, and we had they called them pirate ships, and they would broadcast off of the coast of England, they allowed it, interestingly enough, until we started paying money to have the World Tomorrow on there. And then the government tried its level best to stop them. And the way they did is they wouldn't let him come to port. And they wouldn't let him, they worked it out with the European countries so they couldn't come into port there either. And so they had to finally shut down. See, it had an effect. You know, so, and unfortunately, subsequently, we haven't. I say we, I'm talking about all of the churches of God, whatever name you wish to put with it. We haven't had the effect that we had even back then. And, you know, all we can do is prepare ourselves spiritually, morally, to be the carriers of that gospel.
What I hear from these people, all different ones.
Yes.
It's 24 hours a day. Tune in to TV or channel. 24 hours a day. But they don't mention about the kingdom of God. They talk about the gospel, but not the kingdom of God.
Interesting. Well,
true gospel. The kingdom of God.
We were coming to the place before Mr. Armstrong died that we were becoming noticed, and we were beginning to have an effect, and for whatever reason God has allowed that to change. And we are not, I say we are not having the effect or the influence on this world yet. That's, you know, and the only reason, I say only reason, God has to make that take place. All we can do is to prepare ourselves morally to be that light so that we can have that effect. Even if it's a, you know, even if the world takes it negatively. But we're not reaching the world. I mean, as much as I love what the United Church of God is doing and what it's becoming and so forth, and the Good News magazine and so forth, the world doesn't know about us yet. The world doesn't know about any of the churches of God. And again, I'm not trying to pick on necessarily any group, because I know we all are trying to, you know, do it. We're all trying to do it. But the thing of it is that we have to come back to is that it is God who has to bless it. And, you know, and I look at what's out there, what the churches of God are doing. I see something at 5 o'clock in the morning. I see something on public access television at, you know, later at night. And I see something that is put out by another group, but it's not having an effect, and it will not have an effect until God says it's time, until he says, okay, now I'm going to start doing it. But what we have to do is what I just read to you, be ready. Okay, we're trying to be ready. But we be ready how? Not just by how many magazines or how many programs, but what are we doing to us? What are we doing as far as each other? You know, are we concerned with each other? How can we be concerned for this world if we're not concerned for one another? And I cannot believe that all that is necessary to fulfill the scripture about getting the gospel out as a witness is to somehow or another just blare it out and say, I said it. If you heard it, fine. If you didn't hear it, fine. I said it, and now you're going to get your comeuppance. If that's what we think getting the gospel out, we have another thing coming. Because remember how Jesus Christ handled it? He said to Jerusalem, he said, how often I as a would have gathered you like a mother hen gathers her chickens to protect you, to save you, to help you. He said, but you would not. And so since you would not, then I have no choice. But if our attitude is, you know, all I have to do is tell you that you're a sinner and that Christ is coming and he's going to beat you up and say we have fulfilled our position as a Christian and getting the gospel of the kingdom out, I do not believe that with any fiber of my being. Because we are not emulating Jesus Christ. We are not following Jesus Christ. We are not doing it the way Jesus Christ would want us to do it. If we do not care about this world, and if we do not try to reach them with a message that gives them hope, as well as a warning, then we are not doing our job. And by being ready, by caring for one another, and then caring for everyone, our relatives, our loved ones, those who are not of the church, I believe those are the ones that God is going to give the opportunity to get this gospel out. Which is why we try, you know, we're striving so hard to be truly Christian in every sense. Because part of it is to get this message out. Yes? Yeah, maybe I did misunderstand you, Mr. Belichick, because granted, what, you know, what other denominations are putting out and calling the gospel is not the gospel. It is not only not the gospel of the kingdom, I mean, it is not even, it doesn't even understand what the good news is. You know, what is their concept of the gospel? Well, going to heaven. Under what circumstances? You know, what are you going to do there? What are you going to be like? They have no idea. They have no concept. So how can it be good news? Let alone the good news of the kingdom. So I'm sorry that I misunderstood. Yes?
Mr. Armstrong said that you, Eddie, and basically were starting over.
I don't know if I would use the term starting over, but we have yet a work to do because Mr. Armstrong has been dead now for 13 years. We got almost a whole generation. And so that's not the generation that needs to hear it. It's the end generation.
And China is still poorly.
China and, you know, basically Russia. And, you know, Mr. Armstrong talked about how the leaders of those countries are the important ones to reach, and that's true. But we've got new leadership in Russia. We've got new leadership in China. Haven't heard of us. Mr. Armstrong set us a very good example, and we can follow in his steps to a great degree, but there's still a work to be done. There is a great work yet to be done. There are almost a 500 million more people since Mr. Armstrong died. That, you know, never had their own. You know, I had the opportunity, let alone heard it. So, let's, you know, gear up. Let's keep working on the things we can work on. And when God gives us the opportunity, we'll be ready for it.